All right. Well, good morning. Good morning. Hey, if we've not met, my name is Wesley. I'm one of the pastors here. So glad you are here. This morning, we are continuing our series that we started last week called Tension, Real Faith in a Real World. And really in this series, we're looking at where we as people of faith, we dream of a world where all is made right, where everything is healed and whole. We long for that reality. But we live in this world, right, where there's doubt, where there's conflict, disagreement, where there's broken relationships, fear and anxiety. We're exploring all of these in this series. And these are part of our lived experience. And sometimes we feel the tension between what we have and what we hope for. And in this series, we're exploring what it looks like for us to live into this tension, live with this tension in this world, with our feet firmly planted in this world, not looking to some world to come or just simply longing or waiting for that world that is to come, but leaning in and living to bring heaven on earth right here where we are. And last week, Ruth kicked us off in this series talking about doubt. This morning, I'm talking about handling conflict and disagreement. Now, what a topic. One that's so relevant, and because relationships play a role in all of our lives. And this is a topic that's relevant to all of us, I'm sure, because we all live in relationships, and I'm sure we all have some relationships that we would say are challenging. But relationships are essential and valuable part of our lives. In fact, we were made to live in community with one another. And healthy relationships are life-giving. They're enjoyable. They're energizing. In fact, studies show that a healthy relationship can lower your stress and contribute to your physical health. But challenging relationships have the opposite effect, as many of us can testify. They can cause all kinds of stress and anxiety. They can literally suck the life out of us, causing us to avoid meaningful engagement with one another and leaving us with nothing but superficial, shallow relationships. Man, and we're so divided right now in this country and really all across the world. It feels like everyone has an issue that they or cause that they're passionate about and opinionated about, and safe spaces and room for dialogue and divergent perspectives seem to be disappearing. And sometimes it feels like, at least this is the way I feel, sometimes I feel like I have to kind of tiptoe into conversations, testing the water, so to speak, trying to avoid saying something that's offensive or something that's going to cause even more relationship tension. And I don't know about you, but sometimes I end up settling for the path of least resistance, which is sadly often silence. And my fear is that this is making our relationships shallow and kind of cliquish. And when this happens, I think we miss out on the opportunity to truly know one another, to engage in conversation with each other, to grow from perspectives that are different than our own. And this is so problematic because healthy relationships are a key part, a vital part of a satisfying life and really a strong society. And I have to be honest, I feel like this is like this enormous topic, too enormous to cover in one message. And maybe I'm overthinking this. In fact, I'm probably most certainly overthinking it. But here's what I've noticed about relationship messages. I've noticed that there is a tendency with messages like this to take some practical principles from psychologists and counselors, therapists, to take those and to place them alongside scriptures that say something similar and then present them in a rather reductionistic, maybe oversimplistic fashion as spiritual practices for having healthy relationships. And don't get me wrong, I think there's enormous value in some of these practices. You're probably familiar with some of them or heard some of them before. Things like active listening, things like not letting the sun go down on your anger. I always struggle with that one. Sometimes I always feel like I need to sleep some things off. I need to let the sun go down while I'm angry. things like speaking the truth in love, right? These are helpful practices that we could talk about, and you could apply them to your relationship, and sometimes they do help. And what I've found, at least part of my experience, has been that those kinds of messages people often enjoy because it gives them some practical steps, some things that they can go home today and apply to their life. But I like to think of myself as more of a theologian than a therapist, and there's already a lot of good content out there on the internet, which I'm hesitant to say because there's also a lot of bad stuff on the internet. There's a lot of good content about dealing with conflict and disagreement and challenging relationships. And I also think, and I probably should have said this first before I said go to the internet, but I also think a good counselor and a therapist can work wonders for relationship challenges. And I think all of us need a good therapist on call for either the relationship with ourselves or the relationship with others. So, because I think of myself as more of a theologian than a therapist, I won't muddle the waters with my pseudoscience relationship advice this morning. Instead of presenting these practices and principles for handling conflict and disagreement, I'd prefer to spend some time this morning thinking about a phrase that Jesus uses in Matthew chapter 9, which is peacemaker, or a word that Jesus uses in Matthew chapter 5, verse 9, which is peacemaker. If you're not familiar with that verse, Jesus says in Matthew 5, verse 9, "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God." And so this morning, I simply want to share some thoughts on being a peacemaker or peacemaking as a way of being in the world. Peacemaking as a way of being in the world. Now, Matthew 5, verse 9 is the only place this term peacemaker appears in the Bible. This verse is part of a much larger section known as the Beatitudes, which is part of a much longer section known as the Sermon on the Mount. I think it's Matthew 5, 6, and 7 that contain the Sermon on the Mount. And in this sermon, Jesus presents a message that was quite revolutionary for his time and countercultural in our time. And the Beatitudes are positioned right at the beginning of this section, and they function not so much as commands, but rather as thresholds to a new way of thinking. And they confront us with the question, if we, the people who follow Jesus, are shaped by the teachings of Jesus, what kind of people, what kind of community will we be? Let's just read the first 10 verses of Matthew chapter 5. And if you've heard these verses before, just pretend with me like this is your first time hearing them, all right? So Matthew 5, verse 1 through 10. It says, "Now when Jesus saw the crowd, he went up on the mountainside and sat down. His disciples came to him, and he began to teach them. He said, 'Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven.'" Now, if you hear nothing else in this passage, I want you to pick up on the upside-down, countercultural, not what we're prone to think way of Jesus' teaching. Blessed are the poor, he says. Blessed are those who mourn, the meek, the hungry, the persecuted, right? The language here is signaling to us that the path of following Jesus is just not intuitive, and therefore we can't expect to intuit our way into what Jesus calls peacemaking. In fact, in Matthew's gospel, Jesus calls the community shaped by his teachings the kingdom of God because it forms an alternative kingdom to the kingdoms, the empires, the power structures, an alternative to the kingdoms, the empires, the power structures of this world. And the command that Jesus gives the citizens of his kingdom isn't to take over the kingdom of this world. It isn't to control it. It isn't to rule it. Rather, it's to exist within it as an alternative kind of society bearing witness to the renewing work of God within our society, with an open door to anyone, to everyone who wants to intentionally join in what God is doing in the world. And so the Beatitudes, they're not imperatives, rather they're an open invitation to a different way of life. And it's here that we find this term, peacemaker, along with a number of other different terms and phrases that Jesus doesn't really define. And I think, and I thought a little bit about this, and I think the reason why Jesus doesn't define these and why he just kind of runs through this list is because he himself is the definition. So if you want to know what it means to live as a peacemaker in this world, then we have to look at Jesus and watch how Jesus lived and study his way in the world, because Jesus shows us how to live as peacemakers in the world. And that brings me to my first thought on peacemaking as a way of being in this world. And that is that Jesus is our paradigm for peace. Jesus is our paradigm for peace. Now, personally, I struggle to say that without acknowledging that much of the division, conflict, disunity, and even violence in the world has been perpetrated or endorsed by the church and people who identify as followers of Jesus. I recognize that this can make the decision to follow Jesus challenging. And for some, it makes it difficult to take statements like Jesus is our paradigm for peace seriously. A lot of people want nothing to do with Jesus or the church because of how entangled the church has become in the power structures of this world and how complicit it's been in the oppressive, nationalistic, militaristic, power-hungry, greedy, self-centered culture of our world. You know, we are, after all, meaning-making machines, and we're all born with the ability to process data from the world around us and draw conclusions and connections. And some have reasoned, given what they've seen, that there's got to be a better way than the way of Jesus. And if that's you, I'm not judging you. In fact, some days I'm right there with you because I've seen some of the same things you've seen. I've studied church history, and it's not always been pretty. But on my clearer, more hopeful days, I believe that the way of Jesus is still a path worth following, and that the teachings of Jesus and the kind of community that Jesus committed his life to forming is the kind of community that our world needs right now, and a community committed to selfless, self-giving, sacrificial, indiscriminate love and acceptance is just what our world needs right now. Because our world is filled with fear and anxiety. Our society is changing. In some ways, it's expanding. In fact, there's a lot of good, more inclusive changes happening in society, but as human beings, we just don't deal with change very well. We fear what we don't know. We fear what we don't understand. And it seems to me that we, humans, have a tendency to treat power and control as an antidote to fear and anxiety. And when we fear something, we dig our heels in firmly into our position or whatever issue we're passionate about and use whatever power we have to create a world that aligns with what we believe to be right in this world. And this reliance, maybe even over-reliance on power and control, has produced a polarized culture where everything is black and white, right or wrong, good and evil. There are allies and there's opposition, and we erect strong boundaries to delineate who's with us and who's against us. And this creates an echo chamber of sorts that only serves to reinforce our position and distance us from others who have a different perspective. And ultimately, this polarization, independence on power, has become the source of many conflicts in our world. And I think that Jesus is one of the best examples of having access to power, but laying it down to display the power of love. And that's why we're a community that's committed, a community of hope and transformation that's dedicated to following Jesus, because we believe that the kind of love that Jesus displayed is able to bring about the kind of whole and healed world that Jesus envisioned, a world that we all long for. In our relationships, though, this means intentionally engaging in relationships with people we disagree with. And that is so, so hard right now. Thomas Keating, a theologian and author, helps us understand the kind of love that Jesus embodied, this kind of boundary-crossing love, this love that transcends the barriers that divide us and builds bridges with those we disagree with. He says, we're all like localized vibrations of the infinite goodness of God's presence. So love is our very nature. Love is our first, middle, and last name. Love is all. Not love is sentimentality, but love that is self-forgetful and free of self-interest. I think Keating, who was a monk who spent a lot of time in silence and solitude, understood that it's only as we make space in our lives for the divine loving presence that we can decenter ourselves, that we can lay down our way, that we can draw close to somebody with a different perspective, that we can make space for loving encounters with others, especially those we disagree with. It's this kind of life, this kind of life that does not revolve around self. It's the kind of life that Jesus is inviting us into when he says, blessed are the poor in spirit, blessed are those who mourn, the meek, those who are hungry, thirsty for righteousness, the merciful, the pure in heart, the peacemakers, the persecuted. You see, Jesus is definitely not calling us to assert our position and use our power to obtain it, but to divest ourselves of worldly power and to invest ourselves in the power of love. I think that's what Paul understood when he wrote to the church in Philippi in Philippians 2, verse 5, where he says, in your relationship with one another, have the same mindset as Christ Jesus, who being in the very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be used to his own advantage. Rather, he made himself nothing, taking the very nature of a servant, being made in likeness as a human, and found in the appearance as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient to death, even death on a cross. If Jesus is our paradigm for peace, then the question is, how do we as peacemakers handle conflict and disagreement? I don't quite have an answer for that, but I do know that we must slow down when conflicts and disagreements arise, that we have to seriously contemplate, what does it look like for me to follow Jesus in this situation? What does it look like for me to give up my rights? What does it look like for me to give up my power? What does it look like for me to make space for the perspective of others? What does it look like for me to love those with whom I disagree? Jesus gave up power. We know that. We see that. History tells us that. And he refused to allow power to be used as an antidote to fear and anxiety. That brings me to my second thought on peacemaking as a way of being in the world. And that is, peacemaking is not the possession of the church. What I mean by that is that we haven't cornered the market on peace, nor should we be trying to. In fact, the world is filled with peace-loving religions, and it's going to require interfaith dialogue, collaboration, and education, learning from each other, if we're going to truly become a community of peacemakers who handle conflict and disagreement without descending into disunity and division. In other words, we need our brothers and sisters from other faith traditions. Western Christianity can become so focused on what we can do to make the world right, what actions we can take to handle conflict and disagreement, We're so eager to fix our broken relationships, but Eastern spirituality and other religious traditions help us see the value in cultivating a deep reservoir of inner peace out of which we can live more peacefully in the world. Now, I'm not trying to flatten, nor do I want to sound like I'm trying to flatten the rich and meaningful traditions of other religions, but from Buddhism, we can learn practices like meditation and mindfulness that decenter self and enable detachment from the expectations that we often hold over others. From Hinduism, we can learn from their deep and meaningful belief in the interconnectedness of all beings and the emphasis on seeing the divine in every individual. From Islam, we can see and we can learn from the use of salam or peace as a greeting and also as a principle and guiding ethos for promoting harmony and reconciliation in all interactions. And by learning from the teachings and practices of diverse religious traditions that we live among, we can enrich our understanding of peacemaking and contribute to building a more harmonious, compassionate, loving, and peaceful world. You know, while our faith tradition does offer great depth of wisdom and insight into how to live peacefully in this world, I think we got to remain open to learning from the religious traditions, from other religious traditions, recognizing that, as Martin Luther King reminded us, that we are caught together in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. And I think it was this recognition that caused King and others who were part of the civil rights movement to be open to the critique from religious leaders of other faiths, like Gandhi, who said, which could be something used to be offense, something we could be offended by, or we could humbly listen and learn, right? Gandhi, who said, "It is a first-class human tragedy that people of the earth who claim to believe in the message of Jesus, whom they describe as the Prince of Peace, show little of the belief in actual practice." You know, King didn't just listen to Gandhi's critique, but leaned in and learned from his nonviolent way of being in the world. It's wisdom from Gandhi's Hindu tradition that revolutionized the civil rights movement and led us closer to the conciliation of relationships between the races. You know, there's another quote from Gandhi, one that we're probably more familiar with. Some people question whether it actually came from Gandhi himself or someone else. You kind of hear it around here. It's be the change you wish to see in the world. And oftentimes what I've seen happen with this quote is through our Western ears, we hear it as a call to action, a call to do stuff to make this world a better place. But if Gandhi did in fact say it or say something similar to it, he would have been teaching that first we must be something different, because Gandhi's teachings emphasized personal transformation that's necessary for social transformation, that we must begin within if we want peace in the world. If we want peace in our relationships, there's an inward journey that we must take. You know, there's many Christian theologians and authors who have taught and influenced the way we think about peace, but they've drawn from the teachings of other religious traditions. Like Thomas Merton, a Trappist monk, a prolific writer, he was influenced heavily by Zen Buddhism, and he emphasized that contemplation as a means to foster peace within oneself and then within society. Henry Nouwen, a Catholic priest, theologian, and author, explores themes of spirituality, vulnerability, and compassion in his writings. He drew from Hinduism and Buddhism, integrating elements of Eastern spirituality into his understanding of contemplative prayer and inner peace. And he emphasized the importance of inner peace, as the foundation of peacemaking. And then there's Howard Thurman, who I'm spending a lot of time with these days. I'll tell you about it sometime. But he was a pastor and theologian and author who believed deeply in the interconnectedness of all beings, which he called the harmony of creation. This belief led him to build bridges with people from different backgrounds and traditions. He believed that by accessing something deep within ourselves, that we could find common ground with those we disagree with, the kind of common ground that transcends the barriers that keep us apart. In fact, in 1944, I find this super fascinating, Howard Thurman left a position at Howard University, just kind of up the road, to help start the first interracial, interfaith church in America. And about this experience, he says, "I had to find out for myself whether or not it's true that experiences of spiritual unity and fellowship are more compelling than the fears and dogmas and prejudices that separate men and women, and if these experiences can be multiplied over an interval of sufficient duration, would they be able to undermine the barriers that separate one man or woman?" Thurman believed that it's possible to transcend the divisions that cause that lead to a lack of empathy and lead to conflict and disagreement. But only, he believed, we could do that by going on an inward journey. We had to do some internal work that enables us to see the humanity in others, especially those we disagree with. Drawing from other religious traditions, Thurman established in the church that he started, and that was in San Francisco in 1944, the church he started, he established a time of meditation before the Sunday service, where people would gather in a space and they would go on that inward journey together, believing that that was the only way that we could make space for those with whom we disagree. You know, it's natural and normal for us to want to handle conflict and disagreement. But the wisdom of the great religious traditions of our world remind us that peace and peacemaking must begin within. In fact, Thich Nhat Hanh says, he's a Vietnamese Buddhist monk, he says, "In modern society, most of us don't want to be in touch with ourselves. We want to be in touch with other things like religion, sports, politics, a book. We want to forget ourselves. Anytime we have leisure, we want to invite something else to enter us, opening ourselves to the television and telling the television to come and colonize us." You know, I have a friend who frequently reminds me that we are human beings, not human doings. Sometimes we just need to be still and experience God's presence instead of jumping into action and trying to handle conflict and disagreement, trying to resolve relationship tension or fix challenges we have in our relationships. In fact, and this is the harder lesson for me, is that sometimes there's something for us to learn in those challenging spaces. You see, the wisdom of other great religious traditions of the world teaches us that the divine presence is always present with us to be experienced and encountered. And if we can make space for God, God will help us see the humanity in one another, and we'll make space for others. All right, third thought I want to share about peacemaking as a way of being in the world is that peace, or at least the pathway to peace, is filled with paradoxes. The pathway to peace is filled with paradoxes. And I wish I had more time to talk about this point, but here's the thing I want you to hear. The biblical concept of peace is more than just the absence of conflict, but it's the presence of something better. It's the presence of healing, wholeness, restoration, justice, reconciliation. It's not just the absence of conflict, but it's the presence of something better, something that we all long for. And so silence in the name of keeping peace is not peacemaking. Refusing to discuss certain topics is not peacemaking. avoiding certain people because you don't have the energy to deal with them right now is not peacemaking. It's peacekeeping. Peacekeeping aims to lessen conflicts, but all too often upholds status quo. Now, I'm not saying that there isn't a time and place for peacekeeping. Sometimes a relationship can become so volatile that peacekeeping is necessary. And there's some people that might be so toxic to be in a relationship with that you might need to avoid them for a season. Sometimes for your own mental well-being, peacekeeping is necessary. I just think we got to be careful not to confuse peacekeeping with peacemaking. Peacekeeping is protective. It builds walls around us. But peacemaking is restorative. It renews our world. It brings about wholeness. Peacemaking is about participating in God's work of renewing the earth. And as a community of hope and transformation, we have to have a bias towards peacemaking, not peacekeeping, because Jesus was a peacemaker. And if we're going to follow Jesus, then we must engage in peacemaking too, even when it's hard. Therefore, we must refuse to settle for keeping the peace. We have to refuse to choose the path of least resistance. If we're going to make the world a better place, or at least participate in making the world a better place, we must learn to embrace discomfort and upheaval as a necessary part of the path towards peace. You know, I think this is what Jesus was getting at in Matthew chapter 10, verse 34, where he says, "Do not think that I've come to bring peace to the earth. I have not come to bring peace, but a sword. For I've come to set a man against his father, a daughter against her mother, and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law, and a person's enemies will be those of his own household." This passage, more than any other passage I can think of, encapsulates the paradoxical nature of peacemaking. Jesus is teaching that the pathway to peace will cause conflict and disagreement, even with those who are part of our own family. Because what peace, real peace, entails might challenge in this world often challenges some of the deeply entrenched beliefs of people we are in relationship with. But remember, peace is not just the absence of conflict. It's the presence of healing, wholeness, restoration, justice, and reconciliation. And this paradoxical nature of peacemaking is particularly seen in the pursuit of justice. Because in this nation, we're so divided about what justice includes and how we should go about making or contributing, working towards a more just society. And there are so many times that we know that speaking up will cause relationships to break down. But over and over again, the scriptures remind us that as followers of Jesus, as people committed to making this world a better place, that we have to speak up on behalf of the poor, the oppressed, the marginalized, to make the world a more just place. And while we may feel that our voice doesn't make a big difference, or that our silence isn't really harming anyone, as followers of Jesus, we must find our voice so that we can counter the hateful, oppressive, violent rhetoric that is calling for a less inclusive, less loving, less free-for-all society. I guess what I'm trying to say is that peacemaking, handling conflict and disagreement, is not a clear-cut path. It's not easy to navigate, but we can only navigate it as long as we look towards Jesus as our paradigm for peace. Look beyond Jesus to other peace-loving religions and wisdom that's in this world on how we can live more peacefully in this world. And that we wrestle, that we genuinely wrestle, and we're honest with ourselves about times that we are settling for keeping peace when we could be stepping up, standing up to be peacemakers in this world, contributing to a world that's more whole, healed, just, a world where everyone belongs and experiences the love of God. Well, this morning, just like every Sunday morning, we share in the time of communion. And the band can come on up now. And when I think of communion, when I think of this meal that Jesus shared with his disciples, where he broke bread and he drank wine and encouraged the disciples to repeat this practice in remembrance of him, it always reminds me of some of the hard decisions I have to make in the pathway to following Jesus, in the path to being a peacemaker in this world. And so for me, when I go to the table, it's not so much about remembering the fact that Jesus died, but it's about remembering what Jesus' death means for me, what Jesus' death is calling me to do, to be, to become in this world. And so there's three tables around the room. There's one in the center, two on the side. They've been prepared for communion, where you can go to these tables and you can spend time engaging, reflecting, contemplating how God might be leading you to be a peacemaker in this world. There's also, in these first stations in the front of the room, the racial justice stations, there's actually a new handout there that helps us better understand the conflict that's happening in Gaza and how we can stand for justice. There's also the event understanding seeds of violence in Gaza event that's happening after service, which I would encourage you to stay for so that we can continue thinking about how we might be peacemakers in such a complex and complicated situation. I feel like I need to say that there's also a station for lament that's in the back of the room, you could light a candle, you could spend some time writing about what you're lamenting. Our world is, facing challenges of division and brokenness and strife. Or maybe you want to spend time at the prayer station, spending time in prayer. I think that noun, more than sometimes, at least in my memory, there's a lot going on right now, and it's a space to grieve, to go in, to sit in the brokenness, conflict, not trying to rush towards fixing, to just be, make space for God, and let God lead us. So as you feel comfortable, make your way to one of these stations or stay where you are and spend some time reflecting.